Hello, citizen or citizens of the world. Welcome to the European Show. It's your new one-stop shop for transcontinental politics, society, and the occasional scandal or scandals. I'm Abby Bella. It's 100 seconds to midnight on the doomsday clock, and this is my outsider view of what happened in Europe this week. Let's take a look. Israel is the order of the day, the week, the month, the past two centuries. Carnage. Definitely carnage. More carnage. A lot of carnage. Israel is definitely doing ethnic cleansing. It's doing a lot of things, and it's been doing it for a long time. It's just the situation has blown up. And it's a good thing in the sense that at least this time around, I feel like more people are coming around to the idea that maybe Israel doesn't have a license to kill, even though they think they do, and this is a good example. There's like a switch in the media, like there's been a little bit of a turn, like this, like these conditions of possibility have been kind of open for something a little bit more, a little bit less biased in terms of that kind of a debate, and it shouldn't even be a debate. But let's take a look at what's been going on in Israel. And let's cry together. This is the footage that got a lot of people talking. This is the people chanting in the square. Speak Hebrew, but apparently they're chanting, may their names be erased. Charming. It is spectacular footage. This kind of stuff happens obviously in the region all the time. This is an ongoing, this is like 100 years of unrest. It's kind of sad that it has to that it's taking so long for even there to be any kind of an equal conversation. It's not an equal conversation we're having right now in the media, but it's kind of almost like getting there a little bit more this time. And it's just sad. Like, it's so depressing. I want to cancel humanity whenever I think about this. And it's this kind of, you know, like, the trope is so simple and like in many ways so like vulgar. The alibi for genocide is to be the victim of genocide, and then it's like all okay. And like the propaganda and the Israeli marketing is like incredible. I'm one of you if you're offended by what I'm about to say about the state of Israel, remember, like, I grew up loving the state of Israel too. Like, I thought it was like the best thing in the world. I thought it was like amazing. I loved it. Like, Israeli kids were my friends, and they still are. But I thought that the bombs you saw kind of going in were from the evil terrorist people who were throwing the bombs because they hated poor Israeli children. But then I grew up and I started reading books and stuff. So the kind of like it's heavy, the amount of propaganda that is out there that is like all consuming. And this is not to say that like organizations like Hamas are like innocent snowflowers. This is like a long history of animosity at the end of the day. You're talking about a nation state that was made up out of nowhere, based on some religious scribblings from thousands of years ago, and you have like a people implanted into a place that was already inhabited by other people. That sounds pretty bad to me, and it sounds like trouble. So not to say that you know, like all Palestinian organizations have always been innocent, but it's like at the foundation of the situation, there's like an imbalance of power. And not to mention that Israel, the reason why Israel is so powerful is because we need Israel as Euro-Anglo-America. We need Israel in the Middle East, as basically a military buffer and base, and that's why that's there. And the mess continues, and I just don't see, there's just no end to it. After all this time, is there even any kind of a solution that would be satisfactory with the amount of hate that's going on? I'm really frightened by what's like the Israeli mentality on this. I'm terrified by it, and I guess I'm like extra sensitive to that because I'm speaking from Europe, and a lot of things happened in Europe, and those things happened in Europe. The systematic killing of people, the hatred, the way that a lot of Israeli children talk about Palestinian children sounds to me a lot like Germany in the 1930s. And yeah, I'm sorry, like if it's like beating people over the head with this, but it's like that, but that is exactly what it sounds like. Like just change the name. And it's the exact same narrative, and it's the exact same situation. So yeah, people seem to be more receptive, but it is very, very, very scary. In terms of the European Union angle on this, Israel is like in many ways, like spiritually, in terms of military allegiance, all kinds of things, it's kind of tied to the European Union and definitely to Europe. It's like it's an associated state of the European Union. It's kind of like the child of the, like it's like the child of Europe, really. And if it hadn't been for Europe, none of this would have happened in the first place. And we're like responsible, we're all responsible globally for this situation and for the people of Palestine. And I don't know, like, you know, I want to make some jokes about this, inappropriate jokes about what to do with Jerusalem and what to do with Israel. I don't want to offend people, but I probably will anyway, somehow. But like, you know, like just like get rid of that land. The only solution I see to this ever is like there's so much hate and so much animosity and tension in like a place like Jerusalem, for example, is just like it's a viper's nest. It's always been a viper's nest. Just nuke it. Get rid of it and start again. Build again, start again. Find other places for people to live. I don't know, but it's just like this is never going to be resolved. And if it is going to ever be resolved, this is going to be resolved to the detriment of the Palestinian people. They don't have the Israeli lobby. They don't have the power. They don't have the money backing. And there is no way in hell that America, the USA, will back Palestine ever. And whatever like the progression will be in the situation, every year, every decade, it's going to be more and more systematic and more genocidal until one day people are going to wake up and they're going to be killed, like all of them will be killed. And states like, you know, like in Europe, there's like some obvious offenders when it comes to Israel. Germany, I obviously blame Germany for Israel. I blame the complacency of Germany too, because like from a human rights standpoint, obviously what's happening in Israel has always been happening is a crime against, this is a crime against humanity. Netanyahu is guilty of that. He should be tried International Court of Human Rights. Him and others. It's dreadful. But Germany is never going to be able to not back Israel for obvious reasons. And it's a kind of double bind. It's this constant double bind. Well, because we're victims of genocide, therefore we should bring genocide. Like, I don't know who came up with, like, how it became even some, like, how that ridiculous argument became okay in the marketing schema of Israel. But I guess it did. And it just makes it, like, it just makes everything more icky. But it should be the other way around, you know? We should judge Germany and Israel. Like, if you aren't understanding that what you're doing is genocidal, if you don't understand that what you're doing is a crime against humanity, then who else will? Like, if you people, of all people, don't get that this is wrong and it's, like, repeating history, then we're just lost. We might as well just cancel ourselves immediately. I'm canceling humanity. You're canceled. You're canceled, people. We failed. We failed as a human species. We didn't do our job. We failed. Yeah, so it's terrifying. And it's this kind of, like, politics and, like, it's this, like, economy of guilt that a lot of kind of post-colonial relations can be burdened with and in a non-productive way. And Israel is, like, kind of colonial and post-colonial in all kinds of, like, weird, unusual ways. But one of those ways is this, like, unproductive guilt of, like, because of the sins of the past, there's nothing we can do today. And it's despicable. So, while there's an opportunity to talk about this, even though it is despicable, let's talk about it as much as possible because it might actually bring some illumination to the topic this time around. The problem, of course, with talking about the situation is that a random woman on the internet, like myself, whenever she speaks out against Israel or criticizes certain Zionist intellectual trends and certain ways of doing Zionism or Zionism itself, a random bee on the internet like me might be accused of anti-Semitism, and that is a very tried old trope used by the state of Israel, used by the military industrial North American complex to control people and to prevent them from speaking out against the atrocities that are happening and to prevent them from speaking truth to power. But I obviously have nothing to lose, and I know what I am. But I know that it's something that comes up for a lot of people in terms of their careers, and even my measly career. That's something that you would definitely think twice about before, like, you start speaking out against certain things, which is, like, really just, I mean, that's not, that it doesn't feel like you're living in a democracy. And it shouldn't be this way. And there's, like, a whole paranoia around it. And most people, let's face it, most people aren't, like, deep in the news and deep into politics. And this is not a critique of most people. It's just, like, that's just how it is. People have different interests. They have different, like, situations in their lives. They have different priorities in their lives. Not everyone's obsessed with what you're obsessed with. So, not everyone's that, like, into the subtlety of the situation in Israel, and not everyone understands, because all they get is this propaganda from the mainstream news and from the mainstream policymakers saying, well, you can't criticize Israel. If you criticize Israel, you're an anti-Semite. And if you say something that's anti-Zionist, that makes you an anti-Semite. And that's a very, very dangerous trope. And it's something that's, like, extremely, like, topical in the United Kingdom, because that's how they brought Jeremy Corbyn down here in the Labour Party. Corbyn was leader, when Corbyn was leader, from the beginning, the Labour Party, which had become really centrist, and he was, like, a proper lefty, they tried to destroy him. They hated him. They hated him with a passion, his entire Labour Party. Like, just, they wanted to oust him. And they couldn't quite do it. They tried this way, that way. And he made a lot of mistakes, like, himself, that I would be the first person to criticize him for. Like, for example, the Brexit campaign. But, my God, like, the one thing that got him, the way they got rid of him finally, was the flinging accusations of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. That's all it took. That was the downfall of Jeremy Corbyn. Obviously, I shouldn't have to explain this, but I'm going to explain. Jeremy Corbyn is not an anti-Semite, and he did not make anti-Semitic statements defending the people of Palestine and other people who might not be lovers of Israel is not anti-Semitism. And there was, like, a whole thing, I'm not gonna get into, like, the labor situation in the United Kingdom, but that was, like, the one that reason worked, and people unquestioningly were immediately put off of it. And unfortunately, a lot of Jewish people were put off of it, and for good reason, because the BBC and the mainstream media were telling them that Jeremy Corbyn was an anti-Semite, which was incredibly unfortunate. It should not be the case that we have these like sacred cows of like, well, you can never criticize the state. And also, what's with this like conflation of like the state and the heritage and the religion and the culture and whatever it is that people wanna like identify as their significator of Jewishness? I really don't see the connection. What's Netanyahu got to do with the Jewish people, or like what missiles he sends to Palestine? It's like, we love Israel, this bizarre religious state. We love it. It's a literal ethno state, right? That's definitely the solution to thousands and thousands of years of persecutions that ended in the Holocaust. Yeah, the way to like to counter obsession with ethnicity and rounding people up according to their characteristics and then eliminating them, the way to deal with that is to get all those people with those characteristics in one place and then be obsessed with these characteristics and perpetuate these mythologies of some kind of a purity of race for the rest of humanity. That's like the best way to counter fascism, is to become a fascist yourself. Lovely. Charming. And yeah, so just to be clear, I'm not an anti-Semite. I do oppose to the practices of the Israeli state. I'm not even anti-Israeli state necessarily, but I'm anti the way that the Israeli state was implemented, and a lot of people agree with me. And I think it is definitely dangerous that we can't speak. Like, there's like this whole paranoia about it, you know? Like, you can't say anything, immediately people react. Just like you, in the United Kingdom too, there was like, this like feud. I'm not even in that feud. I don't want to get into it. And I don't want to like, I don't want to say it. I almost don't want to say it because I don't want to get like into it. But there's this like feud about this trans charity for trans people, Mermaids. And some people were criticizing the way that it works. They weren't criticizing that it was like a trans charity. It was like different people criticizing it for different reasons, basically. But because some of the criticism was motivated politically, you couldn't make like a proper, like you couldn't make an honest criticism just of the running of the charity, because it then became this like political thing, and people were like, "Whoa, anyone who says anything against this charity is a transphobe, and you want to kill trans children and should burn in hell, turf." And it became that kind of thing just because, some people who criticize these charities do have bad intentions in mind, but some people might be parts of those charities, or they might be allies, or they might be workers in the social sector, and they're making valid critiques about just like the runnings of the actual institution, and they would be eaten alive for saying like that thing. Because it's the same with Israel. Like, if you say something against Israel, are you an anti-Semite, you turf, burn in hell? Like, it's just so bad. It's like disproportionate and totally wrong. And just to prove my point, I'm going to use someone. I'm gonna use a token Jewish person, well, person of Jewish heritage. This is Judith Butler, famous postmodern degenerate feminist and person who gets to speak on the Jewish situation. And this is an old article from 2003, and this is like so. Still so relevant, sadly. This is Judith Butler speaking on whether it's anti-Semitic to criticize the state of Israel, and the title of the article is "No, it's not anti-Semitic." And she says, what is needed is a public space in which less issues might be thoughtfully debated, and to prevent that space being defined by certain kinds of exclusion and censorship. If one can't voice an objection to violence done by Israel without attracting a charge of anti-Semitism, then that charge works to circumscribe the publicly acceptable domain of speech and to immunize Israeli violence against criticism. One is threatened with the label anti-Semitic in the same way one is threatened with being a traitor if one opposes the most recent U.S. war. Such threats aim to define the limits of the public sphere by setting limits of the speakable. Yep, she's right. That's precisely how it functions. That's how it conspires against us. We must always speak out citizens of the world, we must always speak out. Always speak the truth. As Albert Camus says, and Albert Camus is the patron saint, a spiritual patron saint philosopher of the show, my favorite dead French philosopher, he always says, you know, like, whatever your kind of leanings politically and intellectually, when it all comes down to it, the most important thing and function of the witness to history or intellectual, whatever labor you're doing spiritually or intellectually in history, within history, as a witness to history, the most important thing to be is someone who does not side with the executioners. And that's a motto that I live by, to not side with the executioners, whoever they might be. And that's usually a good way to kind of see, like, who the bad guys are in the situation, just like Israel and Palestine. Like, who is the executioner here? And I don't think that anyone who takes a look at the situation in any kind of a detailed way would say, oh yeah, well, it's clearly Palestine. And there's just so much going on there. There's so much, like, you know, take a place like Jerusalem. It's just toxicity upon toxicity. It's a cursed place. It really, if it were up to me, I would just sell it. Sell it to, like, I don't know, Elon Musk or something. Let him, like, live there in a cave. Nuke everything so none of these religious symbols remain, like, just a hole in the ground. Get rid of it. And just relocate the people somewhere nicer. I don't know, but there's just something so offensive about all the violence in a place like that. And it should be, you know, and in theory, it should be like this happy, symbolic place where all these religions come together and people can be at one. But no, of course not. Of course not. Like, why? That's not what people do. We just want to nuke each other. So, yeah, and there's all kinds of, like, kind of weird things to places like Jerusalem, for example. And this is, like, another kind of European heritage situation. Let's actually take a look at some footage. It's a depressing topic, so let's have a little bit of fun. Here is President Macron last year on a trip to Jerusalem having a fight with the security there.
We know perfectly, everybody knows the rules. I don't like what you did in front of me. Go outside. I'm sorry, but we know the rules. Nobody has to provoke, nobody, okay? We keep calm. We had a wonderful walk. You did a great job in the city. I do appreciate, guys. Please respect the rules. They are for centuries. They will not change with me. I can tell you, okay? So everybody respects the...
This is gold. This is comedy gold. Okay, so the reason why this is happening is because actually the building he's in is a church. It's like a church, a place of worship. And the building itself is under the auspices of France. So it belongs to France. The land doesn't, but the unit belongs to France. So he's, like, actually on French soil. It's, like, a complicated thing. And that's not just, like, one place in Israel. There's, like, four different places that belong to France that are actually France in Israel, but not really France. It's hilarious. And apparently this is not the only place in the world. France has loads of little units in different places that, like, qualify as French, which is, like, hilarious. But... And I understand what Macron is saying, like, to his credit, like, he's actually right. Like, the security went there, like, he couldn't control them. They did whatever they wanted. That's not the protocol for a visit from someone high ranking, like the president of a country. And this is, like, his unit. Like, this is his, like, his corner of Jerusalem, I guess. But the great thing about this footage is that there's, like, a conspiracy theory that Macron was actually mocking someone when he said it, because the same exact thing happened a while ago with a predecessor of his, Jacques Chirac. Let's take a look.
In the old city of Jerusalem, his Israeli bodyguards at one point step in to block him from Palestinian well-wishers. The president, in an extraordinary television moment, loses his temper.
You want me to go back to my plane and go back to France? Is that what you want? Then let them go. And let them do. No, that's no danger, no problem. No, this is not a method. This is a provocation. That is provocation.
It's not a provocation.
Please, you stop now.
So either it's like the systemic Israeli problem, or some people are saying that like Macron like did it on purpose to like mock him and be like, oh, look at me, I'm Jacques Chirac, whatever, and like that he was on purpose putting on this like thick French accent to be like to mock him. I don't know, but I just love this. Like, I love the footage. I love the incident. It shows you like what a stupid, dumb idea it is to have like all these different places of worship and to make it about those places and to like sanctify these things. And I understand, look, like I understand the spirituality side of it. I'm all for spirituality. I'm a very spiritual person, I would say. But I think if your spirituality is causing people to die, then you probably want to find a different kind of spirituality. I don't know. I was just like, that's how I live my life. If people have to die, or if it makes Macron like shout at you, this is like my new test. Yeah. If in a confrontation, my spirituality is going to make Macron's blood pressure go like up, all the way up. Probably not the best spirituality in the world. Or I'm not practicing it right. So this is kind of like a wrap up on the European, like the European lens on the Israeli issues, the kind of European gaze. It's a horrid colonial situation. There's no resolution to it. Even a two-state system now would be so unfair and so unequal. There's just no resolving it. Oh, and the cherry on top in this is that Erdogan of Turkey, like no jokes. Erdogan of Turkey has now officially requested that Vladimir Putin and he intervene in this situation, protecting the people of Palestine. And Putin obviously is this like long-standing patron of the people of Palestine. He Russia does not recognize Hamas as a terrorist organization, and Russia has always been pro-Palestine for obvious military reasons. They want to destabilize the region. It would give them a lot of kind of power. They need to have that in there. But still, like if like the dictator of Turkey is telling the dictator of Russia that they need to do something about these innocent children dying in Palestine, and the European Union is doing nothing about it and saying that Israel has a right to defend itself, then you need to accept as a European that the biggest, most famous dictators of the world are like on the right side of history for once, and you're like on the wrong side of history. Like the moral compass of Vladimir Putin today is far superior to the moral compass of Ursula von der Leyen, who is president of the European Union Commission. And speaking of Putin, indirectly, Alexei Navalny, I haven't done an update on Alexei Navalny for a long time. I forgot about him. Sorry, Alexei. He's alive. He's looking a little bit gone because of all the hunger striking. But it seems like some of the mystery diseases that were ailing him have kind of stabilized a little bit. I honestly thought he was going to die in prison because, well, why not? If I was Putin, I'd probably kill him too. I mean, I wouldn't kill anyone, but if I was Putin, like if I were to like analyze Putin, and if I were to like speak as Putin, I would kill him. I'd definitely poison him. But I don't know, maybe Putin's getting a little bit soft in his old age, who knows. So Alexei Navalny, still alive, but still got like a long time to serve in prison, so who knows what might happen. This may just have been like a decoy or a foreshadowing. And other good news is that Alexei Navalny has been reinstated by Amnesty International as a prisoner of conscience. He'd lost that status for a while because of some connections that came to light a few months back regarding his connection to some far-right organizations in Russia. But the problem with this, you know, these kinds of allegations is that it was a long time ago. He was just kind of up and coming, and he happened to be speaking with, or, you know, through platforms inhabited by these, like, right-wing fascists. And Russia is a very fascist country, so I'm not surprised that he, like, crossed paths with these people. And even if he had been a fascist himself and then had repented and kind of transformed into a freedom fighter, I don't see a problem with recognizing someone's current humanitarian work and someone's current resistance to oppressive power despite a bad past if they've transformed themselves from that past and distanced themselves from that past. I'm all about transformation and change. We all change all the time. Why not give the people the opportunity to have these spectacular transformations? So, Alexei Navalny is reinstated into civilization as a prisoner of conscience and still alive. Well done, Alexei. I feel like every time I talk about Putin, I say he poisons people, and I feel like he's gonna poison me someday. And last but not least is the inaugural conference on the future of Europe. This was an event in Strasbourg on May 9, and it was as fun and jovial and exciting as a European Union event could possibly get, which is not at all, but it wasn't like deadly bad. It was like, it was just whatever. It is important, though. So it opened on May 9 in Strasbourg on Europe Day. And it's this like year-long forum that's going to be open digitally for people to participate in discussions about Europe. The forum has been open for a while. But it's kind of, this is like the year for when Europe really, like these like European Union efforts are very kind of clearly steering people towards a discussion about civic engagement and getting more people to engage. And specifically, they're talking about European youth. So they want to mobilize kind of young people to engage as European citizens, which is not necessarily the way that people of previous generations have tended to engage in the European Union. But studies show time and time again that millennials and Zoomers tend to identify first and foremost as Europeans and second as whatever sovereign country they belong to. So it's not surprising that this would be the natural progression of a lot of talks and discussions in the European Union. And this is definitely a part of a trend to try and mold a path to federalism. And although they don't state it outright, and in fact, the person who's going to be at the helm of this whole forum was Guy Verhofstadt, who is a major federalist in the European Union, the author of The United States of Europe. But they decided not to have him as like the face of this event because they thought it would be a little bit too obvious what was going on. But it's clear that they want to have like more of a narrative about civil belonging, civic belonging, and citizenship. And it's a way to test out the waters too for the future. Certainly, Ursula von der Leyen has said many times already that the future is federalist. She wants a federal Europe. She said, like, every second speech she gives is like, you know, maybe I won't live to see the day, but my grandchildren will live in the United States of Europe. Like, you know, it's clear that there's, like, a federalist bias, which I love because I'm a federalist, too. I think that is the future, and I think the sooner it happens, the better. One concern you could have about this forum is that it is, again, highly exciting to use, which is not at all. Is very clunky. It's it may not be like galvanizing people in the right ways, so it might not be a representative sample of the population who actually engage with it. You can ask questions, you can interact as Europeans, blah blah blah. And it may not always be the target audience you want. You'll have like different types of engagement throughout the different countries. So there's like countries that have been kind of traditionally feeling the feels for Europe a little bit more than others. You might have, you know, Hungary, which is under the rule of a crazy dictator Orbán, who does all kinds of weird things with media, legislation, and things like that. And propaganda in this country, where, you know, maybe the engagement will not be as high there, and then maybe these opinions will not be heard. But from my cynical perspective, no one really wants to listen to what people have to say. This is just an exercise in compliance. This is a consultation. This is democratic consultation being seen to be made, and it's a way to feel out whether there's going to be a lot of opposition in a decade from now when we become the United States of Europe. Will a lot of people hate it, or will I don't know, my generation and the younger generations, will they accept it, basically? Like, how many people need to die out before we're able to do this? And that's usually a pretty political question. Like, how many people need to die? Like, which generation is going to be able to take something? Like, who is the first generation who's going to be okay with a major change? Who needs to die before we do this? This is a dark, dark space I'm inhabiting tonight. But it's true. It's true of a lot of, like, situations where it's, like, you know, certain generations are just not prepared for something. And it's not their fault. It's just because they've been fed a specific type of propaganda. And then the propaganda changes. And, like, the problem is, like, a whole population who have been indoctrinated in one particular way. But yeah, so I think, like, the rumblings in Europe are definitely that we're heading towards a federalist Europe. There's a few hiccups on the way, like crazy Polish dictator, the crazy President Duda of Poland, the crazy dictator of Hungary. But these are characters that come and go, you know. They've done as much damage as they possibly could. They've both been in power for a long time. Eventually, they will dissipate. And the more federal Europe becomes, the less power these people will have over policy and the people in these countries. So the human rights situation will improve. I can't believe I'm saying that, like, about the European Union. There's countries in the European Union where the human rights situation is yet to improve. But it's true. So you should participate in this forum. Let me know if you like it, even if you're not in Europe, or if you're not, like, a card-carrying, born-here European. You should definitely participate to see, you know, how it is, to, like, just find out more about, like, what's going on in Europe right now. I'm definitely gonna be participating to see what's going on, what people think. And even more, just to see how the machine is trying to work, like, what kinds of structures the powers that be are putting into place to get the kind of result, the kind of opinion-making result they want. Initially, there was this proposal from Macron. Again, he's been, like, in my thoughts recently. There's this proposal from Macron that we should, you know, see what the people say and give them some, like, options. And he said something like, without taboo and without limits, and then we just, like, based on this, we would have, like, the opportunity to change treaties and, like, to change the European Union. And Ursula von der Leyen was like, yeah, we should do that. Like, we should, like, go all in. But then there's, like, a lot of backlash, and the cautious nature of the European Union won out. But Macron obviously is, like, a very pro-European politician, very much about that European future. I cannot stress this enough. I detest the fact that his treatment of women is despicable, his treatment specifically of Muslim women. But in terms of the future of Europe and pushing that through, he's been pretty much one of the efficient people, you know, one of the personality people in Europe, one of the people who are going to, in some way, maybe indirectly, but he will definitely be one of the architects, whether we like him or not, of a future Europe. A more united, more federal Europe. The United States of Europe. And now for the fun news. It's always very fun. San Marino, a tiny principality in Europe, is offering what it knows best, tourism. But it's got a twist. It's vaccine tourism. That's right. San Marino is offering bespoke trips to San Marino. And you get a stay at a San Marino hotel together with a Sputnik vaccine. Now, this is the controversial part. Sputnik is not yet approved by the WHO or the European Medicines Agency. It's probably going to get approved. The EMA, European Medicines Agency, has given an estimate of something like June when it's probably going to get approved. It's not officially approved. And there's like a whole bunch of drama about Sputnik because some European countries ordered it and some didn't because they're waiting for it to get the okay. Some people are willing to take the risk. It's a bit of a mess. But San Marino is willing to take that risk. And they're giving you that Sputnik. It's hilarious. It's hilarious. It's also hilarious that Putin called it Sputnik. Like, here I go talking about Putin again. But, like, he's like... I know it's, like, so in your face, like, on the nose, the things he does, but it's just, like, so brilliant. It's, like, so on brand. The fact that he called it a Sputnik, he might as well have called it, like, secret Russian spy. Your secret Russian spy chip inside your brain coming inside this vaccine kind of thing, you know? Like, I'm not saying vaccines are chipped and that people can spy on you. Like, obviously, get the vaccine, and when Sputnik gets approved, get the Sputnik. Get whatever you can, guys, and gals and everyone in between. So as long as it's safe, as long as it's okay for you with whatever medical conditions you have. But I'm not saying that, like, there's chips and vaccines. But calling it Sputnik is, like, this kind of psychological warfare. And it's, like, this, like... I know that Putin, like, is taking it as some kind of a psychological warfare win. Like, oh, these people injecting Sputnik. I win. The Russian Empire wins. Sputniks are back. We're back, baby. But yeah, San Marino is a beautiful place. If you haven't been, I totally recommend it. When it's safe to travel for everyone again, and for yourself specifically. I myself will not be traveling for a while yet. I have some underlying conditions that I need to be aware of, so I'm taking it easy. But for people who are able to travel and are safe because you're vaccinated, that's a fun place to go. I miss going to these tiny little European principalities. It's been a long time since I've been to San Marino. So here's the deal. You have to go to San Marino, and it will be available for this price to anyone who books a hotel or at least 3 nights and returns within 3 or 4 weeks for the second injection. So you just need to, like, invest in your own, like, transport, I guess, in your hotel. But it would be, like, a fun way to get your immunization. I can see that working out for them. I love San Marino. It's so beautiful. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it so much. Wherever you are, whoever you are, until I see you again, take care of yourself and stay safe out there.